Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is Saturday, December 19, 2009. Bill Fink is joining us for Matthew chapter 1. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, yes. Praise Yahweh. And reading Matthew chapter 1, it's patently obvious to anybody with an IQ of room temperature that genealogy matters.
Well, it matters all throughout the Bible, New Testament and Old.
But all
seed only means one thing. It means sperm, and it only comes from one place.
All these modern so-called Christians that say genealogy and ancestry mean nothing and don't matter, and that if it did, the Bible would surely talk about it. Obviously, they're reading a different Bible, either maybe the Scofield one or the Bible of their imagination or the Bible according to the Jews. But Matthew chapter 1, any idiot should be able to look at it and realize, oh my, this must be important since they're tracing the genealogy of Jesus all the way back to, you know, from before David.
That's the whole story of the book. It is his genealogy and ours. I mean, Paul gets into it in Romans 4 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And several other places. However, people read, the church takes advantage of a statement concerning vain genealogies and convinces people that genealogies are vain. The church pulls a Freudian manipulation of words to reverse the meaning of the Bible in the minds of the people.
Yes, so in that instance, correct me if I'm wrong, but when Paul admonished them for arguing about pedigrees and genealogies, that was one basically group of mongrels arguing with another group of mongrels, in which case their genealogies were worthless.
Well, yeah, in most cases. I mean, an Israelite, the teaching is that an Israelite, a child of Abraham, is not supposed to rely upon his genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
However, that doesn't mean that your genealogy doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, you've touched on the issue of the sons of Belial, or Belial, depending on how you want to pronounce it. What exactly does Belial mean?
It's a Hebrew word. It comes from a Hebrew word. It's Strong's number 1098, 1100, 1101. It's in there. There's a whole group of words that mean, that all refer back to something that's mixed. And the lexicographers say that Belial means worthless. However, it's worthless because it's mixed. And,
so
and
they would have
a clear meaning in the definitions of those words.
So they would have us believe it just means certain men, the sons of Belial, when it says in Deuteronomy, are gone out from amongst you. They would have us believe it means certain men, the sons of worthless. Well, that's a worthless translation.
Well, right, it is, because anything that's worthless has to be worthless for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be an attribute that makes it worthless.
So
like a hammer with a cracked hammer. A hammer with a cracked handle.
Or for purposes,
go on. Something that's worthless has to have an attribute that makes it worthless. The reason why it's nothing's worthless without reason.
So they obfuscate the truth by concealing the purpose behind the worthlessness.
Well, right, and the word Belial, it was one of the uses in the Old Testament is of seed, and that's a very apt use. And the seed is worthless because it's mixed. And why is seed worthless? Because it's mixed. It's
because
worthless because it's mixed because of the commandment that thou shalt not sow thy vineyard with diverse seeds.
Mm.
You know, or thy field with diverse seeds. And that should be true of the field of our families as well as it's true of the field on a farm. That's the commandment, and that's what made the seed Belial, was when it was mixed. It became worthless because it's way too labor-intensive. Imagine taking a drum of wheat seed and a drum of rye seed and mixing them in together and trying to sort them out.
Or dumping oil into water and saying it's fit to be drank.
You may as well feed it to the swine because it's worthless. It'll take you years to sort out those two drums of seed.
And in fact, a mixed seed will give rise to a corrupted tree, and no Israelite fruit can ever come from that sort of corrupted tree.
Well, if the commandment's given about our farm fields, it's much more so true of our own genealogy, of our own lineage.
These evangelicals who believe in a universal atonement and salvation for everybody and just willy-nilly throw the Bible away, they would have us believe that we're told not to mix our fabrics, not to plant multiple crops in the same field, but that it's okay to mix your daughters with the sons of Belial.
Well, that's why Paul, in I think it's in Hebrews, I don't have the verse offhand, but he talks about making common the sacrifice of Christ. And to make something common in Hebrew, what meant to share it with heathens or people outside of the faith or people with whom it did not belong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what modern evangelicals and modern, well, Catholics, they all do it. They make common the sacrifice of Christ, meaning they share it with people other than for whom it was intended.
And if the Holy Spirit had wanted Paul to preach a universalist message, we would have the epistle of Paul to the Somalians, Paul to the Cambodians, Paul to the Arabs, Paul to the Edomites, Paul to the Turks, Paul to the Mongols, but we don't have any of that.
Right, and what we have is we have an epistle of Paul to the Corinthians, which basically is representative of all the Dorian Greek tribes, because the Corinthians are Dorian Greeks, and Paul tells them that their ancestors were in the Exodus with Moses in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And in order to understand that, one has to understand where the Dorian Greeks came from, and we don't find that in the Bible. We only find scarce references to the ships of Tarshish, and why did Dan remain in ships, and Asher abode on the seashore and kept safe in his breeches. And these references go all the way back to Judges chapter 5 and the Song of Deborah. So we have to turn to secular history and the Greek classics and the Roman classics to find out where these people came from. And it's very clear that the Dorian Greeks came through Crete from Palestine and into Greece and conquered the Danann Greeks, who were also Israelites, who were the Danae in all of their own stories that came from Egypt, the tribe of Dan. And once we understand that Paul is telling the Corinthians that they are, that their fathers were in the cloud and the sea with Moses, well, understanding the history, it all makes perfect sense. And Paul told the Galatians that they were descended from Isaac, Galatians chapter 4. And Paul told the Romans that Abraham was their forefather, Romans chapter 4. Over and over again, he told these people of the dispersed that he went to, that they were the nations that descended from the loins of Abraham according to the promise. Paul went to was an Israelite of a dispersion. And there were several dispersions of the Israelites, not just one.
Isn't that who he said he was writing to his brothers abroad?
Well, he knew it. He absolutely knew it. He was a student of the classics. He had an education that the other apostles didn't have because they were simple fishermen, and Paul was a professional scholar.
So Matthew chapter 1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David,
Abraham. That can be translated, in my translation that says a book of the descent of Yahshua Christ, but it could also say a book of the race of Yahshua Christ. As the Greeks saw the word genos to mean.
This is the same generation in the sense that Noah was found perfect in his generations and his ancestry.
Well, right. We popular culture has taught us to misuse the term generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jews and their media and they're responsible for pop culture. It's their culture. Pop culture is Jewish culture. And they've abused the term. And they've totally perverted the meaning of the word.
Like the word bastard.
In the Bible, a generation is a race, and even if it is, as it does on few occasions, talk about people living at the same time, it fully denotes in Greek people of the same race living at the same time. In other words, no matter how much you tried, you could not be a member of the same generation as a Hutu or a Tutsi or a Mandingo. It just ain't happening. It's not possible that you could be of the same generation. You might be contemporary in a temporal sense, in a time sense, but you're not of the same generation because you just didn't come from the same origin.
When he called the Jews a generation of vipers, he wasn't calling them a period of time of people that are vipers. He was calling them a race of vipers.
Absolutely. And that's proven because he's talking about them having been responsible for the deaths of the project of the prophets from Cain to Zechariah, from Abel to Zechariah. Only Cain's responsible for the death of Abel. So he's talking about fathers and sons, saying you are the sons of your fathers and they killed them and you build their tombs. So therefore, since he's talking about fathers and sons, both near and remote, then the word generations has to mean race.
And again, in Matthew 24, when he says, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled, well, clearly that period of time, those people are long dead.
Well,
they're
well,
not
right.
hiding out in caves.
I translate that, this race, genos, shall not escape, and that's an interpretation of the verb eklipo. However, this race shall not escape until all these things shall have come to pass.
Now, in this instance, what race is he talking about?
Well, it seems to me that he's talking about the races of the Canaanites and the Edomites who were about to kill him. That they're not going to get away with murder. That's an interpretation, but
certainly
to me that's
the
valid interpretation.
That's the promise of Scripture in Obadiah.
And not only in Obadiah, but how about Malachi? And how about the parable of the wheat and the tares and the epistles of Jude and Peter and the Revelation itself?
In Matthew 21, that the kingdom will be taken from them and given to those who bring forth the fruit.
And Zechariah 14:21, and there's probably other Old Testament prophecies also.
Would you like to continue with Matthew chapter 1, sir?
Abraham begot Isaac. This is going to put everybody to sleep. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Then Judah begot Perez and Zerah from of Tamar. And that's important, that line right there. Because, you know, Judah had three other sons, and they're not mentioned. And that's because they're Canaanites, and they're not worthy of mention.
You said Judah. In the King James, it says Judas.
Well, it's all variations of the same Greek word, which is actually Judah. And it says Judah in my translation. And that's actually, the Hebrew name is Yehud. And for some strange reason in English, when they transliterated it, they swapped around the D and the H, and it became Judah. And I can't get into the minds of the Englishmen of the 1600s, I'm sorry. And Phares begot Hezron, and Hezron begot Aram, and Aram begot Aminadab, and Aminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon, and Salmon begot Boaz of Rahab. And Boaz begot Yobed of Ruth, and Yobed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king. Now it's important to notice, and there's one more, and that's Bathsheba, or the wife of Uriah, that the four women mentioned in Matthew, these four women just happened to stir much controversy within mainstream Christianity, and even within Christian identity. And I did a program with Clifton Emmerheiser on the Voice of Christian Israel back a couple of months ago, proving, more or less at least in my own mind, that all four of these women are actually either of Israelite stock or they are of white Semitic stock in the case of Tamar. And there's no doubt. And It's odd that it's like the authors of Scripture, who I believe are fully inspired by Yahweh, actually knew that somehow the divine will knew that these four women would be the source of much controversy amongst later generations of Christians.
Which four here? I see Tamar, Ruth, Jesse. Would the fourth one be the...
Well, we haven't mentioned the wife of Uriah yet, but she's in the next verse.
Okay.
Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who actually was not a Hittite. The book of Jasher, I don't give it full credence. The book has some problems with interpolations. However, Tamar was definitely an Elamite, or, you know, she was definitely Adamic, but the book of Jasher says that she was an Elamite, which is a Persian and a Shemite. But, you know, the sons of Jacob couldn't marry Israelites because the only female Israelite was Dinah, and that was their sister. They had to take wives from the other white nations around them, Adamic white nations around them.
At the time, and for probably another millennia or so, the Persians were white.
The Persians were white probably up through the time of Muhammad. And beyond that, until Islam caused some mixing in Persia.
Because Islam tears down racial barriers.
There may have been, you know, we can't say that there wasn't any mixing between along the Indus River and in that area. We can't say there wasn't any mixing. And we can't say there wasn't any mixing with the trade routes into China, the Silk Routes, and there probably was. But for the most part, Persia proper, which is modern-day Iran and part of Afghanistan, or most of Afghanistan, was an absolutely white nation up until the Islamic invasions after the 7th century, which would have caused mixing because Islam does purposely break down racial barriers, and the Mongol invasions of the 10th and 11th centuries. The Turks were never, and they don't seem to have ever been an organized military invasion into Iran. It's kind of like the Mexicans in America. That's the way I picture it anyway. That they actually
just, here.
Just kind of flooded into the nation in waves. I might be wrong about that because I'm not really a student of the Near East in the medieval period. But it seems to me that Turks were the Turks seem to be organized by the Arabs in the employ of Arabs. People, you know, Turkish leaders like the Seljuks seem to be mercenaries for the Arabs in all of the incursions against Byzantium.
The Seljuks did pour across Persia, and they ended up conquering probably 95% of Persia before they moved on into the Eastern Byzantine Empire.
Right, and those invasions changed the nature of Persia racially.
Mm, totally.
But before that, it was almost assuredly nearly all, if not all, white.
And then the Mongols came basically right on the heels of the Turks, so... Persia was basically was the first nail in the coffin, and then the Mongols finished the job.
And they're all Islamic today. These are the Muslims today. And it's clear in history that, and I really learned this recently in my studies for tonight's show with Clifton, is that the Arabs were buying Turks as mercenaries and using Turkic slaves to conquer Byzantium, for its attacks on Byzantium. That was all done, in other words, that was all done at the behest of the Arab merchants. The destruction of Anatolia and Byzantium. Okay, where were we? David begot Salmon from the wife of Uriah, who wasn't really a Hittite. He was actually an Israelite. Hittite by that time was a nickname for a great warrior.
So it's a translation issue.
Well, that's a misunderstanding of the idiom by the King James translators. That's correct. He was not racially a Hittite. He was an Israelite. He was one of the men of David's guard, And he was actually called the Hittite because it meant brave warrior by this time. And that's right. And you could look that definition up right in Strong's Concordance. It's in there. And Solomon begot Roboam, and Roboam begot Abia, and Abia begot Asaph, and Asaph begot Josaphat, and Josaphat begot Joram, and Joram begot Ahaz, and Ahaz begot Jotham, and Jotham begot Achaz, and Achaz begot Hezekiah. Then Hezekiah begot Manasseh, and Manasseh begot Amos, and Amos begot Josias. And Josias begot Jeconias and his brothers at the time of the sojourn in Babylon. And I'm reading it from my translation and not the King James,
right.
So I'm sorry about the funny pronunciation of the names. But that's
with
the
Arias, the Hittite, would you say it'd be comparable with referring to someone as, oh, he's a real cowboy or he's a trooper, and then 500 years from now, people don't know the colloquialisms and they think, oh, he must have been a trooper, he was in the military, or he was in law enforcement, or he must have been a cattle rancher.
After certain movies that came out a few years ago, if you call somebody a cowboy, I might think you're referring to his sexual proclivity. And that's the way language that's the way language changes the meaning of words. That's
popular culture distorts and perverts language.
Absolutely, and this isn't the first pop culture we've had in this day and age, that's for sure. Okay, they had pop culture back in the Greek world too, and it caused the demise of Greece, I swear. Now, there's a problem, and I'm not blaming Matthew, but there is definitely a problem with the genealogy here in verse 11, because Jehoiakim or Jehoiakim is missing. And that kind of throws a monkey wrench in the 14 generation thing. But that's just the way it is. And I'm not going to be able to pretend to answer why, because all indication is that Jehoiakim is the father of Jeconias. And that's, you know, the Old Testament, 2 Kings, chapter 23, and much other testimony to that. However, here he's missing. So if we add him in, then there's 15 generations and not 14. So there is a slight problem in Eugenia, and I have to point it out. That's just the way it is. And that shouldn't cause anybody to disbelieve the Bible, but it is a problem. And it very well may be that Matthew was working from manuscripts which omitted him. And in those days, Herod had tried to destroy the genealogies. Herod went into the temple and destroyed all the books of the genealogies and ordered them destroyed. So there were a lot of problems with valid copies of Scripture in those days.
But that's because Herod knew he was a usurper and he had no claim of birthright to the throne.
Right. He knew that the Edomites weren't written in a book, and he knew that he couldn't establish that he had descended from the royal lines. And he didn't want any challengers to the throne, so he had the genealogies destroyed so that nobody could say, look, this is me. And that was purposeful. And I'm sure that the apostles worked with what they had. But there is, when you go to and examine the Old Testament as we have it today, one generation missing right here. Now I'd like to talk about this Jeconias, and Jeconias is actually cursed by Yahweh, and it's at the end of Jeremiah, chapter 22, is this man where he's called Coniah, and is this man Coniah a despised broken idol? He is a vessel wherein is no pleasure. Wherefore are they cast out, meaning the Israelites, because this is the final deportation to Babylon that Jeremiah is talking about, and his seed, and are cast into a land which they know not. O earth, 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 hear the word of Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling anymore in Judah.
Mm.
And that came true, because Jeconias was taken off to Babylon, and none of his descendants ever ruled again, even though he did have descendants. And Joseph, the father of Yahshua Christ, legally descended from Jeconiah. But none of those people ever ruled over Judea. And that's because of that curse of Jeconiah. However, Christ gains because he's the legal heir of Joseph, but not the physical heir. He gains the scepter or the right to rule over Judah through Jeconias, but he's not technically of Jeconias's issue or seed.
But
you see what I mean?
At the time, the presumption would be that any children born in a marriage were fathered by the husband.
Well, right, and that's why Cain inherited the world. That's why it's said in Genesis, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 4, Cain is told that he would rule over Abel. And that's why we have all these problems, because Adam accepted Eve, Cain becomes legally the heir.
Despite the fact that nowhere amongst the descendants of Adam is anywhere Cain listed. It just says in Genesis 5, this is the book of the generations of Adam, and it goes
well,
on
exactly.
to list.
Exactly. But Adam accepted Eve in her condition, and Cain becomes the legal heir, even though he's not listed anywhere as being Adam's son. And the same, Christ undoes that. He undoes that. He reverses that exact same thing.
And that was one of the main points of his coming.
Absolutely.
So these evangelicals who believe that he came to become their own personal savior, they couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, they're clowns. They evangelicalism is the best religion the Jews could buy. And that's exactly what they did. They bought it. They bought it with Cyrus Schofield. They bought it with Bullinger. They bought it with a few other of those turkeys whose books have been on bookstore shelves for 100 years, because those people rewrote Christianity for the Jews, for Samuel Untermeyer, Jacob Schiff, and Bernard Baruch, and the House of Rothschild.
Well, I asked them very basic questions, such as what was the purpose of the creation and what was the nature of Jesus' atonement, and they don't respond. They just flat out do not respond. Occasionally I'll get a response, but it's always a personal attack that never deals with the issue.
Of course not. But one of the most important lines in the New Testament, and everybody misses the importance of it, is in Peter's vision, where Yahweh says to Peter, do not call common what Yahweh has cleansed. And in order to understand what he has cleansed, we have to go to the Old Testament prophecies, which can concern redemption, and which concern the new covenant, and which concern the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, and they all say to Israel, I have cleansed thee. And they all have to do specifically and explicitly with the house or the children of Israel, period.
So
end of story.
He came to cleanse lawbreakers. He can't cleanse people who were never under the law, because they
Absolutely.
Couldn't have broken the law.
Absolutely. They didn't need to be cleansed. They didn't have that covenant relationship with Yahweh. They weren't the wife of Yahweh as a nation.
So when the evangelicals say that he came because people were sinners and they needed to be saved, well, how could the Somalian or the Hutu or the Bantu or the Cambodian sin, since the law had never been given to them? And what is sin if not transgression of the law?
And well, they don't have that law unless they're under that covenant relationship. That was the purpose of the giving of the law in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 19. They entered into the covenant relationship. Then they received the law as a condition of the covenant relationship, period.
And of course,
and that's why Paul tells the Galatians. Now, the Galatians were also Israelites. The Galatians were actually Celts of the dispersion of the deported Israelites. That's where the Galatians descended from. That my German origins papers on my website prove it.
Were they in Anatolia?
Paul told, yes, they were in Anatolia, that they lived in the ancient land of Phrygia, and which was, it was Phrygia in the most ancient times, you know, at the time of Homer and the Trojan Wars. And the Phrygians, there were still some Phrygians left in the area, but they had been basically destroyed as a as a contiguous political unit in the 7th century B.C.
And are these Galatians related to the Gauls of modern France? The Celtic?
Well, it's the same exact Greek word. It's the same exact Greek word, the Galatahi. And the Strabo, the geographer, describes tribes of the Treri and other Galatahi tribes of the Galatahi. And he explains how they speak the same language, and they have the same names, but they live like half of Europe apart from each other.
That would be a curious coincidence. Someone in California being identical to somebody in New Jersey and speaking the same language, yet they've never been in contact.
Well, I mean, that's what we have today, you know. That's what we have right now.
But I imagine that they weren't in contact through the internet. They didn't call each other on the phone and say, "Hey, your name's so and so. I'm named so and so. Let's speak the same language."
No, they had the same tribal names. They had the same language, right? There's no doubt that the people the Romans called Gauls, and the Roman, wherever you see in the ancient writings, in the Greek writings, the word Galatahi, in the Roman you'll see Gaul. That's you know how all of, at one time the Greeks described all of the Germanic people as Galatahi. And then later on they split them into diverse groups. And the Romans called them all Gauls until they decided that the Gauls on the east of the Rhine seemed to be the source of all of the Gauls west of the Rhine. So they started calling them Germania or authentic.
I'm reading on your Wikipedia here. They say that the Galatians were Celtic people who migrated into Anatolia and that they eventually settled amongst the Greeks and were absorbed, but they spoke the exact same language as the Gauls in Gaul, but it doesn't say where they originally came from.
Well, they can't say where they came from. I mean, my papers explain where they came from, every little detail that in the Greek sources that I read. I'm sure I could fill in more details from sources I haven't yet read, and there are a few. However, I think I have enough there in my Germanic origins essays. However, the mainstream sources have been trying to say that the Gauls came from the west to the east for a long time, the Celts, and it's a much more complicated story than that. But the Galatians of Paul's time did come from beyond the Bosphorus, from north of what we know as modern Thrace. It's modern Bulgaria now, I'm sorry. And they came from that region in the 3rd century. And they had a war with King Attalus of Pergamus.
All right.
And they tried to sack a few temples, and they had this battle with King Attalus of Pergamus, and Attalus prevailed. But he didn't prevail decisively, and he made a treaty with them that they could have this ancient land that used to be Phrygia, and move right into it, and that's where they settled.
So they would have come from the Roman region of Dacia, modern Romania?
Well, they came from northern Europe, yes, or from Europe north of Greece. There's no saying exactly how far they ever traveled west.
All right.
Not all of the. It's very clear in Strabo and in Diodorus Siculus that many of the Cimmerians, who were the ancestors of the Galatahi, settled along the Danube River Valley and in places in the Balkans and in what we would know today, as northern Italy and Macedonia and Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, in all that land, all strung along between Anatolia and the Black Sea and France, we find people described by language as Celts. And there's no doubt that they didn't all travel all the way west. But a lot of modern-day historians claim that they never traveled west in the first place, that they were sourced or their origin was in the west. And that's just not true.
So they claim that they originated in the West and traveled East, when the reverse is the truth.
Yes. And there's many historians of the 18 and 1900s, archaeologists and historians, and I have a book on Christogenia from a scholar of the 1800s named Pritchard, James Pritchard, which is named The Eastern Origin of the Celts. And that book is somewhere on Christogenia, or it's somewhere on my website. I don't know exactly where, but it's there somewhere. Where are we in Matthew?
I believe we left off on 16 and 17. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Wasn't it
12,
14. You just got done talking about Euconius and how there's one missing generation.
Right. Then after the sojourn in Babylon, Jeconias begot Salathiel, and Salathiel begot Zorobabel, and Zorobabel begot Abiud, and Abiud begot Eliakim. Now remember that this Zorobabel is the one who was the leader of the group that returned to Palestine to rebuild the temple in 516. Okay, so Jeconias went to Babylon, and two generations removed from him returned to rebuild the temple. And that story's told in Ezra and Nehemiah. And Abiud begot Eliakim, and Eliakim begot Azor, and Azor begot Zadok, and Zadok begot Akim, and Akim begot Eliud, and Eliud begot Eleazar. And Eleazar begot Mathan, and Mathan begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, or Maria, in my translation, from whom was born Yahshua, who is called the Christ.
Well, this Zorobabel, isn't this just another piece of evidence then that the Jews can't possibly be Jacobites, Israelites, the people of the book? Since again, we've discussed this in John chapter 8, when Yeshua confronts them and he says that he knows they are of Abraham in a sense, and then they say that they've never been in bondage to any man. If they were descended through Zorobabel, they would have been caught up in the Babylonian captivity. But the only descendants of Abraham who could say that they were never in the captivity would be those of Esau.
Well, absolutely, and that's exactly who they are. And you have to go back to, if we go to Ezekiel 34, we read about the lost sheep.
Mm.
And then when you go to Ezekiel 35, you read a prophecy, and the prophecy says that, you know, it's about Esau. And Esau there, of course, Esau himself is long dead. It's representative of the Edomites, his descendants, saying that those two countries shall be ours. And if you go to the Apocrypha, to I think it's Sophia Sirach, okay, which is the Wisdom of Sirach. And it's an apocryphal book, and it's very much like the Psalms or the Proverbs. It's probably more like Proverbs. And it tells you explicitly that the Edomites, the children of Esau, helped the Babylonians tear down the temple. And after all of the last of Judah and Israel had been removed from the land, the Edomites moved into Judea and Israel from the ancient land of Edomia.
So they took those two nations then, like it says, and I'm reading
just
here,
like
Ezekiel
it says,
5:10, because thou hast said, these two nations and these two countries shall be mine, and we will possess it, whereas Yahweh was there.
And that's exactly what they did. These Edomites gave these returning Judahites a whole lot of strife when they tried to rebuild the temple in the city. And even though Cyrus made the first decree in 539 BC, the temple didn't get built until 516. And that fulfilled the 70 years of desolation. However, that was due to the strife that the Edomites and other Samaritan peoples, you know, people in Samaria that had been brought in by the Assyrians, had given the Israelites, rebuilding the temple in the city. Now, the city wasn't actually rebuilt until the time of Ezra in 455.
So, the Judeos who believe that the Jews are Israel, who do they believe dispossessed the Jews, if the Jews are Israel, of those two nations, and then who took possession of them?
Well, it's very clear in the book of Malachi, for instance, right? it talks about the priesthood and the sacrifice. And Yahweh says that all the sacrifices of the priests are unclean to him because his covenant is with Levi. Read the first two chapters of Malachi. And if Yahweh's saying that the sacrifices the priests make are unclean
because
the covenant is with Levi, then that means that there's priests making sacrifices who are not Levi.
They're not of the covenant.
Right. So who are these priests? And then you got to go into Josephus and see that in one, I mean, Eli James dates it a little differently than I do, but I date it to about 130, 135 BC when John Hyrcanus, one of the Maccabees, and the Maccabees were actually a family of high priests. They were Levites who had taken over the rule of Judea. And that helped, you know, make the curse of Jeconias come true, because the Levites ruled the kingdom in the intertestamental years and not Judah. And the Maccabees were definitely Levites. And John Hyrcanus decided that all of the heathen people that lived in Judah, which was mostly Edomites, should be converted to the religion of the people in Jerusalem, to Hebrewism. So he goes out and he conquers, and it's recorded in Josephus' Antiquities. He conquers all of the surrounding cities of the Edomites and forces them all to convert to the religion of the people in Jerusalem, which by this time was called Judaism by the Greeks, because it was the religion of Judah. So the Greeks just called it Judaism, and that's the name that stuck in history. And he converted them all to Judaism. And Josephus makes the very plain statement that here and after, that they were all circumcised, and here and after they were nothing other but Jews. Or Judah. Or Judeans. Or however you want to translate it. So all these Edomites became Judeans. And Strabo, the geographer, he mentions this when he wrote, and he died in 25 A.D., And he was a Greek, and he was a pagan Greek, and he had no axe to grind and nothing to prove. But he wrote the same thing, and he wrote it 50 years before Josephus did. So it's if you look up Herod Archelaus on Wikipedia right now, Archelaus, and you'll see that even the Jews admit that he was the ethnarch of Judea, Samaria, and
Edom.
Edomia. And even the Jews on Wikipedia admit that. There's no way around that. It's a historical fact. The only people that don't know it are 200 million dumb Christians. It's incredible. But that was the cause of all the division in the kingdom, as we're about to see if we ever get to Matthew chapter 2.
All right.
Okay. Therefore, all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the sojourn in Babylon are 14 generations. And as we've seen, there's a problem with that, and I guess Matthew got poetic here, but there's no reason to doubt this from the veracity of the manuscripts. Because this, all the manuscripts actually, for the most part, agree with this reading. And from the sojourn in Babylon under the Christ are 14 generations. Now, the manner of the birth of Yahshua Christ was thusly. Maria, his mother, being betrothed to Joseph, and betrothed only means like engaged, as we use the word engaged, that they're not supposed to be having sexual relations yet. Maria, his mother, being betrothed to Joseph before their consummation, had been found having conceived in a womb by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not wanting to make an example of her, desired to put her away secretly. In other words, what she, you know, this is a horrible situation, and he doesn't want to bring her out in the town square and say, look, we haven't consummated this marriage yet. She's been screwing around on me. He wanted to put her away privately.
And he wasn't. And he certainly wasn't wanting to have her stoned to death.
Well, yeah, right. That too. Then upon his considering these things, behold, a messenger of Yahweh appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, you should not be afraid to take Maria your wife, for that which is in her is engendered from of the Holy Spirit. And she shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Yahshua, for he shall save his people from their errors. Now there's two possible etymologies in Hebrew for the name Yahshua. And it could mean either one, and nobody can really argue convincingly in favor of one or the other. However, in my own writing, I lean towards the fact that it means Yahweh saves, Yah and Shua. However, if you look at the Hebrew pronoun, the third person singular masculine pronoun, because the name Yahweh means I am, and it's basically made from a Hebrew pronoun, or from a Hebrew verb, okay, it's a Hebrew verb, and it's very similar to some of the Hebrew pronouns in its forms, and Yahshua could also mean he saves, okay, so it could mean he saves, or it could mean Yahweh saves, and this tends to allude to the fact that it means he saves, and it doesn't matter to me which one's correct. And we could argue all day, but the bottom line is that nobody can actually, with 100% surety, say which one is correct. And it shouldn't matter, because we know that the he and he saves is Yahweh anyway, right? I mean, we should as Christians. So I don't even split hairs, and I usually, in my own writing, I ignore the he saves possibility, just for the sake of simplifying things. Now, all this happened in order that which had been spoken by Yahweh through the prophet would be fulfilled, saying, behold, a virgin shall conceive in a womb, and she shall bear a son, and they shall call him Emmanuel, which is interpreted, God is with us. And that's Matthew that wrote that. That's not a later parenthetical statement by some scribe. And Joseph, arising from sleep, did as the messenger of Yahweh commanded him, and took his wife, yet he did not know her until she bore a son. He did not know her, meaning he did not have sex with her, like even a serpent, and until she bore a son, and he called his name Yahshua, as he was instructed to. And Emmanuel does mean God is with us. And if you want to go find Isaiah 9:6 and read that, that's what this is quoting. I mean, if you want, I could bring it up in a second. Now, I would like to say that a lot of people contend with Isaiah 9:6 because it's not found in this form in the Septuagint. And the Dead Sea Scrolls usually support the Septuagint readings. But in this case, the Dead Sea Scrolls support the Masoretic text readings. So I definitely lean towards the fact here that the Masoretic text is, in this instance, fully correct. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. So basically, that attests, as Matthew does here, in the fact that the birth of Yahshua Christ is the birth of Yahweh in the flesh as a man. Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, I just noticed here it says, and knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son. So much for the Catholic doctrine that Mary was perpetually a virgin. The Gospel of Matthew says otherwise.
Well, right. And the Catholics, you know, it's all about lust and virgin worship, basically. It is... Mm. Sums up quite a bit of the Catholic attitude.
Like the Vestal Virgins in Rome.
Well, right, and they're the Catholic nuns, or the forerunners to the Catholic nuns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that whole perpetual virginity thing. Actually, it's a, I think it's some Jews' white person population reduction plan, you know, to get all these good men and women into the priesthood and into the order of nuns. And then tell them they can't multiply. That's
Isn't that in direct contradiction to basically the first thing Yahweh told Adam, be fruitful and multiply?
Well, it's in direct contradiction to the scripture from front to back. I mean, Paul says a bishop should be the husband of one wife. And a man that doesn't rule over his own family can't rule over the household of Yahweh. So if you're going to be a virgin and not have a family, or well, I don't know about the virgin part, but if you're going to abstain from normal sexual relations with a woman and not raise a family, how could you
help raise up the community?
Right, exactly. And a priesthood of perpetual, and I don't know what word I want to use. It's deviance, because you got to be a deviant as a man if you don't at least want to perpetuate your family line. We should all have, I mean, not all of us are successful at it, but we should all good men should desire it. Then you've got to be a deviant if you don't desire that. And that's what they are. And because of that restriction against marriage, the Catholic Church has attracted all sorts of sexual deviants to be priests.
But that's
actually not even the problem. The problem is that we have priests in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing in the New Testament that approves or condones or calls for a professional priesthood. Leaders of communities are chosen by the community. The community chooses its ministers and its servants and its bishops, if I have to use that term.
Since now a Catholic Church, the congregation has a priest imposed upon them from without. They have no say, no involvement.
Right, and that's evil. And especially today, where so many good white communities are getting these Zulu witch doctors as priests imposed on them from without.
Would you like to continue into Matthew chapter 2 today, or?
Well, if you want to read a paragraph and give my voice a break.
All right. Now, when Yeshua was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born? We should just read king of the Judeans, king of the Israelites?
It should be king of the Judeans, because that's what it says in Greek all throughout the book.
Where is he that is born king of the Judeans? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, why would Herod be troubled?
Well, all Jerusalem with him was troubled. And the Magi, in direct contrast, had rejoiced. They were happy. And if you were the devil and fate was knocking at the door, you'd be troubled too. And that's why Herod was troubled. And it shows the nature of the people.
So he was a usurper, and he was troubled because the rightful heir was coming.
Well, exactly. And that's the meaning of all the parables, that he was a usurper. Go on.
Again and again, there is the heir, let us kill him and seize the inheritance.
Right. And they clearly weren't the heirs, were they? Neither could they be.
Or the story about, what is it, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence and the violent take it by force.
Yep.
Now, if the kingdom of heaven is some place off in the sky or in the clouds, how could it suffer from violence and how could the violent take it by force?
Well, that's, I don't know, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance and dichotomies in thinking all throughout Judeo-Christian thought.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have when you have the devil. You allow the devil to formulate your Christian doctrine, and mm-hmm. Judeo-Christianity is the result.
And that is the great goal of the Jew, to wipe Yahweh's people off the face of the earth so there can be no kingdom then. Because they hope that if that happens, the prophecies that we've been told will be fulfilled, the destruction of the Edomites, the coming about of the kingdom, and the end of Satan's mastery over the world, they're hoping that those will all either be forestalled or just indefinitely on hold, and that they'll basically remain in possession of the kingdom that they've seized through their own violent behavior.
Well, that's the will of the devil, is to always resist the will of Yahweh, right? That's the purpose of the enemy. That's right from the beginning.
But the great promise of Scripture is that everything that has been turned upon us will be turned back on them, and whereas they sought to destroy us, they will be the ones who are destroyed. And
right.
The kingdom will be restored to the people who deserve it.
The faith of the saints is to believe that and to look forward to that day.
And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search diligently for the young child, and when ye have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also. Now, who but a Jew would be this deceitful and wicked, saying that he wants to come and worship also, but he's really plotting a massacre?
We could see the same exact patterns of behavior all the way back then, can't we?
Mm-hmm.
It never changes. That's the same Canaanite bait and switch routine that they pull in Walmart today.
Help the children by killing the children.
The Magi were a priesthood among the Medes and the Persians, who were first described by Herodotus, who wrote before 430 BC. They were quite influential, and apparently not all Magi were good Magi. That they became involved in court politics. Upon the death of Cambyses, the son of Cyrus, one particular Magi, called Pseudo-Smerdis by the Greeks, even usurped the Persian throne. Until the intervention of Darius, later called the Great, it is highly probable that the Magi were Israelites or even Levites of the dispersion. At Ezra 8:17, we see that the great scribe has sent to a place called Cassithia, needing Levites to attend to the temple. This happened just after 458 BC. Dr. George Moore, on page 203 of his book, The Lost Tribes and the Saxons of the East and the Saxons of the West, says that Cassithia can be identified, and this makes perfectly good sense, with the place called Caspiana by the Greeks, which is on the Caspian Sea and what today would be identified as Azerbaijan or part of old Armenia, and inhabited at that time, at Ezra's time, the Greeks tell us that Scythians, the people known as the Scythians, inhabited the region of Caspiana. This place is mentioned by Strabo in the 11th book of his geography, and it's mentioned several times by Diodorus Siculus. So this Caspiana of Ezra is a region and a city and a district mentioned as being inhabited by Scythians. And Ezra sent there for Hebrew priests. Why would he send the Scythians for Hebrew priests? Because the Scythians are the dispersed children of Israel. There's all kinds of ways to prove the identity story. And this is clearly one of them. And this can't be answered by people that doubt the identity story. They could have no rebuttal for this. It's not possible.
I think they would immediately resort to name-calling and distractions.
Absolutely. That they have no choice. They would have to resort to name-calling and distractions. All the scoffers. But the Israel identity story is absolutely true. The Magi obviously understood the significance of certain prophecies, which we may not even longer have. I mean, there's no mention of the star in the Old Testament. It's just, yeah, you won't find it. I'm sorry. It might be in some apocryphal books, but I haven't read them yet myself, and I think I read all of the apocryphal books that we have left, and there's obviously a lot of books that our ancestors had that are missing now.
Maybe they've been totally destroyed, or they're under lock and key in Tel Aviv.
Well, yeah, one or the other, or the mythical Vatican basement, you know, or Gerald Mosley's house. I think they're probably there. That's a good place for them. There's all kinds of books there. And anyway, the men chosen to be apostles and the Israelite woman of Samaria, they also expected the coming of the Messiah at that time. It's very clear that the men chosen to be apostles said, "We have found the Christ," that they expected him to be coming. And the woman at the well said, "I know that Messiah comes soon." So she definitely knows and expects the Christ. And that woman, that Samaritan woman, was actually an Israelite woman, and the text of John chapter 4 proves it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all kinds of people anticipating the arrival of the Christ. And that's clear that they had to understand what Daniel's 70 weeks meant.
And that woman at the well, she's an allegory or a metaphor in regards to how many husbands she's had, and the one she's with now not being her husband. That's how many times the Israelites backslid and took up with other people.
Well, yeah, a lot of people make that relationship. I'm not gonna scoff at it. I don't necessarily see it that way, but I'm not going to say that that's not a good allegory to make.
But that's just more evidence that she's not possibly a Samaritan, since the Samaritans hadn't engaged in that sort of conduct and that number of occasions.
Well, she's obviously not a Samaritan when she tells Christ that our father Jacob built this well,
mm-hmm.
and he did not deny her that. He agreed with her by being silent. If she was an Edomite Jewess, he'd have said, you're not Jacob's seed, or spoke some parable to her in denial. But he fully agreed with her.
And then she probably would have tried to throw stones at him.
Absolutely.
Isn't that basically all the Edomites had throughout the Bible, is every time Jesus got done with a teaching, they would try and throw stones at him?
Well, that's what the Jews do today to anybody that wants to tell the truth. They want to throw stones at them. That's their own innate nature.
That's all they have.
Yes, and it's proven every time. They want to drown your voice out, throw stones at you, shut you off, hang you, stone, whatever. Throw you in prison. They want to shut you up.
The last thing they want to do is debate.
Well, a Jew can't engage in honest debate, and you can't win a debate with a Jew. You can't win a moral victory over somebody that has no morals. It's just the bottom line.
And you're not going to change the opinion of Satan.
No, never. He's the devil. He's the adversary. They're always going to be like that.
The benefit then, or the purpose of exposing the hypocrisy of the Jew, is solely so our people that aren't awakened yet can see it.
Well, right. And you hope that you always have that, hold out that hope that you're going to awake some of your brethren. But there's so much more apt to believe the Jew. It's incredible.
Shall I continue with Matthew 2 here?
Fine.
When they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned of Yahweh in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of Yahweh appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." Now, if Herod were actually of Abraham, wouldn't he be anxiously awaiting, eagerly awaiting the coming of the Messiah?
Well, there is no doubt that Herod, the Edomite, he is the representative of the great red dragon, okay, who stood in front of the woman and tried to kill her child in Revelation chapter 12. There is nothing else that this prophecy in Revelation 12 could be referring to. Not all of the book of Revelation is in the future. The people that believe that the whole book of Revelation is in the future from the time John wrote it are just being silly. A lot of it's in the past, in John's past, because it's a revelation. It's a revelation of basically what Yahshua wants to reveal, and some of that history is necessarily past.
And the dragons... Oh, should I go ahead and read that?
Yeah, sure.
And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,203 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night.
That points to the false accuser is what Diablos means. Mm. And that word is translated devil in the New Testament by the King James translators. And it loses the entire sense of the word when it's translated devil.
Mm.
And that's exactly what Revelation's talking about. It's talking about that race that's been opposed to us ever since the creation of Adam and the seduction of Eve.
Haven't they always been false accusers?
Yes. Look at Job. Look at the accusations that Satan made before Yahweh concerning Job.
Hmm.
That you know, he loves you because he has everything that there is to have, but if he didn't have all that, he would curse you. And Yahweh said, well, go ahead, take it off him. And we'll see if he curses me. Basically, that's the story of the book of Job.
And I forget, what was it that Paul was finally executed for? What false accusation did they get to stick against him?
Well, anything that is conjecture, because I don't think we have an actual historical... You know, Nero had him executed.
Hmm.
He wasn't in Judea. He was arrested. He was arrested on a false charge, yes.
But he pointed out that he was a Roman citizen, and he had the right to be appealed directly to Caesar. And didn't they say that if you appeal unto Caesar thou shalt go?
Well, that fulfilled two things. First, Paul had already been told, as he admits in the book of Acts by the Holy Spirit, that he had to go to Rome. So that got him. That was his ticket to Rome. It wasn't the way Paul thought he was going to Rome, but that's the way he went. And that shows us that, you know, we're going to do the will of God, and even if we want to do the will of God, we ain't going to do it exactly the way we think we're going to do it. Because Paul thought he would go to Rome, but he didn't expect to go in chains as a prisoner. Now, the other thing it fulfilled was that Paul knew there was no way he could ever, if he agreed to a trial in Jerusalem, he would be bound by its outcome. Okay, and the only way they could try him in Jerusalem is if he agreed to it. And he knew that there was no way he was going to get a fair trial in Jerusalem. So he had no choice but to appeal to Caesar. And the only way he could appeal to Caesar is because Paul, having been born in Tarsus, was a Roman citizen. Christ had no appeal to Caesar because he was not a Roman citizen. And that's the laws of Rome. So
right.
Christ couldn't have appealed to Caesar even if he wanted to. But that's just the way Yahweh planned it all. Huh?
All right. And was there until the death of Herod that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of Yahweh by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceedingly wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they are not. So it seems that the Jews like to make up stories in their Talmud. It says that the Romans killed 16 million Jewish children in one city alone in Judea by wrapping them in scrolls and burning them. It seems that the main difference between the Jews and the people they accuse is that the Jews are actually guilty of the crimes they accuse others of.
Absolutely.
So
that's
true. I got done reading on a forum, some hideous Jew was claiming that German soldiers were twirling around Jewish babies by their legs and feet and smashing them against the sides of walls and in trees. And I said, yeah, just like in World War I, everyone was sure the Germans were throwing Belgian babies in the air and catching them on bayonets. Then it turned out it never happened, and it was just wartime propaganda. Just like 6 million Jews died in World War I at the hands of the Kaiser, no one believed it, so you had to wait 30 years and try again. They've always been full of false accusations and lies. Nothing changes.
No, the nature of people does not change. By their fruits you know them. Mm-hmm. Over and over and over again. Christians just don't see that. It's incredible to me, you know, because even as an apostate Catholic, long before I heard of identity, I always thought that there was something really fishy about the Jews. I never liked them. I never trusted them. And I always knew that somehow they couldn't possibly be who they claimed to be. It just wasn't possible. And I always knew that the Holocaust stories were all garbage. I never knew why. I never knew why, but I never believed them.
It occurred to me, if the Jews were God's chosen people, how is it then that basically all the communists are Jews, most of the Jews are communists, and the Jews are basically at the forefront of pornography? None of that seemed to mesh well with their claim to being God's chosen people.
Not only pornography, but the entire illicit sex trade. Mm-hmm. The Jews have been the panderers all throughout history. They're the gambling casino owners. They're the racetrack owners. They pander to our weaknesses, the weaknesses of our people, and many of us fail and cave into those allurances. And that's the way it is. That's Satan doing the will of Satan in the world. That the Jews fulfill that role perfectly.
They're the administrators of his fiefdom.
Absolutely.
But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of Yahweh appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. And he arose and took the young child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he had heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea, in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go hither. Notwithstanding being warned of Yahweh in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee, and he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene."
Right, and let me say that the early history of Nazareth is very sketchy.
All right.
And I don't find a city in the Old Testament. It doesn't exist in the Old Testament. It's a city that appeared in later Judean history.
Is there anything noteworthy of Galilee? Should we note anything about Galilee?
Well, Galilee, it's the ancient land of Zebulun and Naphtali, up in the area around the Sea of Kinnereth, also called the Sea of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's above Judah and above Samaria.
And 11 of the 12 apostles will come from Galilee, correct? All except Judas.
Right. And Judas comes from Kerioth, which is a city of Judah, of Judea, by the border of Edom, which is all the way in southern Judea. And Judas was definitely an Edomite, no doubt about it. He was
so,
a Canaanite Edomite. "Have I not chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil?"
So even Jesus Christ wasn't able to convert Judas, yet the modern evangelicals think if they try harder, they'll be able to.
Well, Judas wasn't he wasn't a devil because he was going to betray the Christ.
He was a devil because he's of the devil.
Yeah, he betrayed the Christ because he was a devil. Yeah, you know, it's the other way around. He betrayed Christ because he was a devil.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they act. That's what they do. It's natural. It's innate. It's in their genetics to do that.
And I'm reading Jewikipedia. It says that he was given account of the money bag. Jewikipedia fails to mention that he was robbing the money bag.
Well, right. According to John, he was robbing the money bag. And wherever you find a Jew or a treasurer, you'll probably find a Jew.
You have a Jewish accountant. You better check the books yourself.
Well, you bet. The first place you fail because you have a Jewish accountant.
Exactly.
It's incredible, but they get their way in every time. And the most profound thing I ever realized, and I say it all the time, is that during the American Civil War, the secretaries of the Treasury on both sides were Jews.
So, just put it this way: if you have a Jewish accountant, get used to being poor.
Absolutely.
So we see the Jews in the same role back then as they are in today. 2,000
right.
years later, nothing has changed. They're still false accusers. They're still demons in human form.
Right. And today, Judas Iscariot would be working as the treasurer for Enron, right?
Can the leopard change his spots? Can the Ethiopian change his skin? How then can ye, accustomed to do evil, do good?
His name would be Fastow.
So who would the modern Herod be? Rahm Emanuel?
That's very likely. Dwight Eisenhower? I mean, name one. It doesn't matter.
They're basically all interchangeable. One's as good as the next.
They're all going to act the same way. There might be debate over which one of them is going to screw us a little faster or a little slower. But if there's a Jew in control, you know one thing, you're going to get screwed. That's what devils do. There's no doubt. They're going to steal from you. They're going to rob. They're going to sell your country out to China or to the highest bidder. There's no doubt.
And yet these Judeos have the audacity, either through their ignorance, arrogance, or their conscientious selling out for the Jews' gold, to claim that the Jews have been a blessing to this nation and that we're the most blessed country in the world. And I have to wonder, has their brain been on snooze for the last 5 decades, or are they just that stupid?
It's incredible that they're just that stupid. They have to be stupid. I mean, I don't know how to explain that. I don't know how to explain that the Judeo-Christians don't see what's become of Western civilization and Christendom at the hands of these usurpers, at the hands of these imposters. It's incredible.
Well, Richard Wagner said the Jew is the demon behind the corruption of mankind, and I've used that quote before, and it's one that I really like. I think it sums up everything.
Well, a lot of old adages are seen to be absolutely true when we look at this. Ignorance is bliss. It's absolutely true. It's incredible. And Yahweh will, you know, your eyes can't possibly be opened unless Yahweh wants you to open your eyes. That's the way it is. And once you become knowledgeable of all this, it hurts. That's the way it is. There's no way around it. Ignorance is bliss. Okay.
All right. So tomorrow at 9 p.m. we will have Kevin McDonald on.
I'll see you then. That'll be great. Right. And I'll have Clifton Emmaheiser here and on the Yahweh's Covenant People show in about 98 minutes.
All right. Yahweh bless.
Yahweh bless. Take care.